Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. We're pleased because joining us today is New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, a Democrat who has been in office since 2010 after serving in the state Senate. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here, Alan. Thank you very much.
Well, I guess the first thing on my mind is elections and Citizens United, that awful decision from the Supreme Court, which opened the way up for money and buying elections. What are you doing about that?
Well, it's a very interesting situation because, as you, I'm sure you know, I've carried a lot of campaign finance reform bills when I was in the Senate. Before I was in the Senate, I was on the board of Citizen Action, and we were working to try and have public financing programs to get the influence of big money out of elections. It was always hard to really galvanize voters around this as an issue, but the reaction to what happened in this year's election and the orgy of spending on attack ads by these shadowy independent donors, people are really upset about this now, and I think the moment is right to move in to clean up our campaign finance system, which in New York State is really pretty appalling. So there are three elements that I see emerging as a part of our campaign and as a part of really a national campaign. The first is there has to be a long-term strategy to get Citizens United reversed. That's going to take some time, but it's just bad law. I mean, it is like, you know, no disrespect for the Supreme Court to say, we're allowed to say we think they got it wrong. The opinion was based on the idea that there was no, there would be no corruption or even the appearance of corruption if there's unlimited spending by donors in support of or opposition to a candidate. It's a ridiculous assertion, and I think that the record is going to contradict that very quickly. The second thing we have to do is, in the meantime, while we still are living with this regime, insist on full disclosure and transparency, and making sure everyone knows who's paying for ads, who's supporting a candidate. And the third is mechanisms to really reduce the damage of the Citizens United world by, most importantly, having public financing of campaigns, which is something that I know the governor is committed to and the assembly is committed to, and hopefully when the Senate configures itself, we can get that done, because we cannot stop people from making contributions right now or spending money. We can raise the floor for the candidates who aren't getting that kind of big money so that we can at least create competitive races like the system they have in New York City. So my office has taken a first step on item two, which is disclosure and transparency. I regulate as Attorney General all of the nonprofits in the state. We have a charities bureau where thousands and thousands of 501c3s and c4s are registered. We have regulations that govern our activities here, and I proposed last week new regulations that will be added to our existing regs that are going to require any group that spends money raises money in New York, does any business in New York, and spends money on New York state or local elections to register with our office and disclose their itemized expenditures and their itemized list of contributors. Currently, there are these 501c4s, which are supposed to be social welfare organizations, that have emerged as the biggest loophole to the requirements of disclosure of donor identity that we have faced. We know hundreds of millions of dollars were laundered through 501c4s, which, again, it's named after a section of the Internal Revenue Code. They're supposed to be nonprofit organizations dedicated to promoting social welfare. We know that some of these groups came into New York and paid for attack ads in state Senate races. Obviously, everyone got to see what was being done in the presidential, congressional, and Senate races. But what they don't realize is that while some folks went through super PACs and PACs, that means you always have to disclose the donors. Everyone knows Sheldon Adelson gave a lot of money to Newt Gingrich. If you do it through a C4, we have no idea who the donor was. So we've issued regulations saying that if you're going to do this in New York State, our Charities Bureau is going to require disclosure. And we're very excited about it, and we think it can set a national model. We're going to have hearings around the state before we finalize the regs, but everyone in New York is going to know who the donors are who paid for attack ads. We're just not going to allow that to happen in the elections coming up this year for county executives and New York City mayor, Buffalo mayor. There's a lot of local elections on the ballot this year, and I'm trying to move this regime of regs into place so that New Yorkers will at least know who's trying to influence the outcome of an election.
Has the governor signed on to this? Does he like the idea?
Yeah, the governor indicated that he supports this. He also has his own more, you know, ambitious agenda in other areas that my office doesn't deal with, and I'm fully supportive of his efforts to do that. Public financing, which is just something that we've been working towards for years as far as people trying to clean up the elections in New York State, is within our reach now. And I think that the governor has a focus on that. He mentioned it last year in the State of the State, I believe. And the public is galvanized after this year's campaign in a way they never have been before to demand reform of the system for our electoral process. It's just broken. You can't have the hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on attack ads not know who paid for it. I mean, we're talking about corporations that might be paying for it whose, you know, people may not have any idea they're doing it. So that's something we can shut down through our regs. That's the biggest loophole as far as disclosure goes. But as far as actual fixing up the Board of Elections and installing public financing, that really is the governor's agenda, and I'm fully supportive of the efforts to do that.
Well, Eric Schneiderman, let's go to the next big story on everybody's lips this week, and that's guns. What do you think we can do to mitigate the amount of assault weapons and other things that are on the streets?
Well, I think there are a lot of things we can do. This is an area, and again, when I was a senator and I was the ranking member of the Codes Committee and then the chair of the Codes Committee, I was a sponsor of a lot of legislation to try and fix this. I mean, most notably, micro-stamping legislation that would require that every automatic gun have a special imprint on the shell casing, because that's the most popular gun used by gangs. Police find shell casings at the scene of crime all the time, and this would be a huge law enforcement tool. I also sponsored bills to try and ensure that we have renewable licenses so that people can't have a license for life, which you can have in a lot of parts of New York now, go to prison, come out, you know, have mental problems, still have your license. There's a lot that we can do, and we actually took a big step forward in our office because we launched a sting operation on gun shows and demonstrated with video surveillance that no matter how crazy a story my investigators told the gun sellers, none of them were refused a gun. And this was, you know, they were saying, I just got out of prison, my wife got an order of protection against me, and the police took away all my guns. Every one of them was able to buy a gun, including assault weapons. So we have entered into an unprecedented agreement with gun show operators, not just the people who sell the guns, but the people who convene the whole gun show. And they're two of the biggest operators in the state have agreed to follow a set of rules of tagging guns and making sure that everyone goes through a background check before they leave the gun show. The law in New York is so bad that there's not even a penalty for a gun show operator if at one of their gun shows some seller sells a gun to someone without doing a background check. So we've gotten them to go beyond the law, but that's something that can be fixed statutorily. I think the idea of renewable licenses is important. I think at the federal level, they really do have to take action, and I'm hopeful that the president and the vice president, who's been given this task, are going to do something to ensure that we have universal background checks. I think something like 40% of the guns sold in America are not getting background checks because of private sales. And we also can ban the most dangerous forms of assault weapons. But I think that the most important thing here, again, is disclosure. I think the public is demanding action, and I think it's there for us. And I do think in New York State, whether they have a special session or they do something early in the coming year, this is the moment to strike and get some more things done legislatively and administratively. There are other things we can do. It is too easy for people who either are criminals or have mental health issues to get a gun. in New York. We have to change that.
Policing Wall Street is my next issue. I noticed in the paper yesterday, the New York Stock Exchange is apparently being sold to a group that deals with derivatives. Could you explain all of that to us?
Well, I don't know the details of the transaction,
right.
But this is derivatives, or it's not really like a share of stock in a company, really essentially bets on products that imitate the way an aspect of the market moves. So a derivative could be based on the price of oil. It could be based on how a certain group of stocks, say the Standard & Poor's Index stocks, how they fare. So this is a huge area of underregulated, in some cases unregulated activity. And this is the new, sort of the new reality. Now, the federal government is supposed to, through the Dodd-Frank process, be bringing some more order to the market. But as you know, that process is taking longer than we thought, or longer than it was supposed to. But, the stock exchange, this is reflecting this huge growth in these other markets over the last 10 to 15 years. And it's really, in many cases, much more like gambling than it is like investment. It's not based on an analysis of, this corporation's well-run, they've cut their costs, they're very efficient, they got a product people like, so I want to invest in it. This is really just more a bet on the way markets are going to go. So it's a huge area, and the old-fashioned exchanges that are supposed to make sure people can put money into the companies they believe will fare the best because they believe in the quality of their work and products, that's really receding as a primary investment vehicle. I'm very concerned about the slow pace of the rulemaking. I'm concerned about the reckless deregulation that took place over the last 15 years that led to the crash of 2008, and I'm working with my federal counterparts to try and both investigate misconduct that led to the crash and to get a set of rules in place that will enable companies to do business, enable people to get their investments into productive securities and other assets, but also ensure that we never have the kind of deregulation that led to the blow-up of the housing market and the mortgage market. And there are steps that can be taken to do that. And the president appointed me as one of the co-chairs of a really unprecedented federal state task force to investigate the conduct in the mortgage-backed securities market. The folks who issued all these mortgages pulled them together into stocks, really, or securities, and sold the certificates for a share of those mortgages. And we know at the last part of the bubble, 2006-07, they were putting a lot of very bad mortgages into these securities, and that led to a crash, and that led to the meltdown in the economy. So we're investigating the bad misconduct in the past while looking to new rules to make things safer and better for everyone forward.
But in the meantime, Eric, are you going to get involved in the sale, in the potential sale? Because it sounds like the repercussions might not be so healthy.
Well, it's not something that, as we understand it now, and this is, I'm not familiar with the details of the proposal, and it hasn't actually happened. It's just a rumor that talks are going on, and none of us really know what the terms are. It's not something that my office has jurisdiction over. We can't intervene to stop the sale, but it's something we're looking at closely.
I know you've had a substantial role in the recovery from Superstorm Sandy, people ripping things off, price gouging, that kind of thing. Can you tell us a little about that?
So the Superstorm Sandy really is, if people who haven't been out to the South Shore of Long Island or the Rockaways or Staten Island don't really, I can't imagine what it's like. It's miles after miles of devastated houses that have just been washed out. The rebuilding costs and the repair costs are going to far exceed, I believe, what we're probably going to get from the federal government, although the fight is on now, and our intrepid congressional delegation's down there fighting hard to get more money. But as soon as the storm happened, we convened a group of my different bureau chiefs and decided to do two things. The first was we have a lot of experience in dealing with price gouging, which is a statute that my office enforces, and we sent out warnings and have received hundreds and hundreds of complaints, investigated them, brought charges against some folks for jacking up the price of gas, much higher than, not reflecting any sort of problem of supply and demand, but just to take advantage of the crisis. Other products, generators, batteries, and we're concerned about contractors who really aren't licensed contractors coming in where people are desperate for help. We just actually took action against a tree removal service for price gouging. So that's one area that our office operates in. And the other is that we're conducting an ongoing investigation to see if any of the anyone broke the law, either in their obligations to prepare for the storm or in their response to the storm. And that includes utilities, healthcare institutions, their environmental issues that our Environmental Protection Bureau is dealing with, which might relate to things like sewage treatment plants. So we're taking a multi-bureau broad look at just ensuring that people did what they were legally and contractually obligated to do.
I know that the governor set up a Moreland Act commission to look into some of the ramifications of what went on there. Does that put your office and his on either a competitive or, you know, cooperation?
Well, no, the Moreland Act commission has set forth in, you know, the governor's order that created it, is taking a much broader look at prospective remedies, you know, what should be done, what could be done, looking at our systems for emergency preparedness and other things like that. We're just simply doing an investigation into whether or not anyone broke the law or violated a contract. We're looking at what happened our investigation is going to take a lot longer. I know the Moreland Act is trying to issue a report by early in the new year. We're subpoenaing records and deposing people, and we're performing our function as a investigative and a prosecutorial office. We're just doing the same kind of investigation we do if we thought anyone broke the law in any other area, and it's a much narrower focus. I mean, we're empowered to go after folks who break the law, and that's what we're doing. The Moreland Act Commission has a broader, more ambitious prospective agenda, and I think that we all look forward to seeing what the report is they produce, but that's not going to deal with the issue of whether or not a particular person or institution broke existing laws.
I talked to a group the other night who were headed by Natalie Merchant and who were very concerned about hydrofracking. You know, this is of great concern to many people in New York State. I'm wondering what your office is doing.
Well, we represent the state, and one of the functions of our office is that we're really the lawyer for state agencies and entities, including the Department of Environmental Conservation. So that sort of sets the parameters of what we're able to do. I've been very active in trying to ensure that all appropriate safety and health studies are conducted and that the process is done scrupulously. We have been fighting with the federal government over whether or not the Delaware Basin Commission is going to do a full environmental impact study before they issue rules, and that's an area that could affect New Yorkers but covers activities in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So we're making sure that the process is followed correctly, and beyond that, we're looking forward with interest to seeing what our client comes up with. I think there has been clearly the activists who have raised concerns about hydrofracking have had a huge impact and slowed the process down, and there obviously are going to be a lot of limits put on it when it is allowed to go forward in New York State. And this has been looking at it purely as an interested observer, this has been an incredible piece of organizing work that these activists have done to really galvanize public opinion on it. And I think the state has responded by taking a very, very careful approach to the issue. And I look forward to seeing what they come up with.
Now, the Defense of Marriage Act is about to be tested before the Supreme Court, and I know you have some thoughts about that one.
Yeah, I do. I do. Well, we've taken the lead in one of the two cases. The Supreme Court just agreed to hear the New York case in filing amicus briefs, and we have some other states working with us on this. I feel very strongly that the Defense of Marriage Act has to be struck down. It essentially goes against centuries of American tradition and American law, really directing that states have to recognize marriages in other states. And this is something that's an area that has clearly been committed to state law. States decide issues relating to family law and marriage. And the Defense of Marriage Act breaks with that tradition by saying a New York marriage legally, you know, undertaken in New York State, in our state, our marriages are not entitled to the same respect from other states as, and so there's, you know, other states' rules, and it's really not fair. It's not in keeping with, you know, the doctrines of comity and respect for states' statutes, which is a really basic principle of our federalist system. So I'm feeling very confident that we have a strong argument that DOMA should be struck down and that the Supreme Court, I hope, will be receptive to it and responsive to it. It's really pretty outrageous if you think about it. We now have 10 jurisdictions that allow a same-sex marriage, and it's DOMA says you don't get fair treatment for those marriages from the federal government. They don't have to be recognized by other states. I don't want a person who's married in New York, a New Yorker, if they have to move to a state that doesn't allow marriage equality, to have their marriages treated as ineffective, or they're not being entitled to the same rights as people who are married in that state or any other state. So it's a very strong argument. It's something that I feel strongly about and that I do think we will have success in the Supreme Court about. Everyone is entitled to have their marriage recognized, and I don't think that a law that essentially says, and to people in New York right now, you don't get federal benefits even if you're lawfully married in New York if you're a same-sex couple. And if you move to a state that doesn't have same-sex marriages, they're entitled to deny you benefits too. Totally unfair, not in keeping with our tradition of recognizing states' supremacy in the area of marriages, and I think we're going to get the Supreme Court to strike it down.
Well, I hope you're right, personally speaking, and I just know that you've got a right-wing court sitting up there being very conservative, and so good luck to you on that.
Well, but keep in mind, part of the tradition of conservatism is the respect for the federalist system and for state jurisdictions in certain areas, and marriage and family is undeniably an area that has always been committed to the jurisdiction of the states in our federalist system, and I think that we'll get a response to that argument.
Okay, then finally, you said it earlier in the thing, when the state Senate configures itself, you're an expert on the state Senate, you were in the state Senate, you have this weird power-sharing relationship between the Republicans and four or five now Democrats, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Can it work?
Well, I have a very strong interest in seeing that whatever they set up is done lawfully, because I have to defend state statutes. Actually, we had a challenge to our marriage equality bill we were just discussing by someone who said that because the governor had met with some Republican state senators, it was a meeting with more than one political party represented, therefore should have been subject to the open meetings law, so the way the statute was passed was unlawful. As the person who has to defend the Senate and its law, the laws that pass and are signed into law by the Senate, Assembly, and governor, I'm going to just be very interested in making sure everything is done in keeping with the law, that things like the open meetings law is taken into account, and that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, because I don't want to be defending statutes because of arguments that the Senate didn't configure itself properly. We'll wait and see what agreement they come up with, and I hope that whatever comes out of this is going to produce a good functioning House. I have a lot of personal affection for people in the Senate, and nobody wants to have dysfunction. I think everybody in both sides of the aisle wants to be able to see bills move forward. I don't know what this is ultimately going to look like. We haven't seen any drafts of revised rules or anything, but I'm going to have to defend them once they're enacted. So I am prepared to work with my client to make sure that things are done right.
Well, you're getting high marks, Eric Schneiderman, and we thank you so much. Our guest on the Capital Connection has been New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Eric, keep doing what you're doing, and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Ann. Happy holidays to you and to everyone else in Albany or Massachusetts or wherever you are.
Thanks again.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.